My name is Tyler Fornes, and I am one of the co-hosts of the Good, the Bad, and the Hungy AEW podcast here on the Voice of Wrestling Podcasting Network. We take a broad scope approach to the world of All Elite Wrestling and the entire universe of Tony Khan. We talk about the big matches, the big stars, the promos, the storylines, and we also look at it from a big picture perspective. How are things going to change over the course of the next 10 years with AEW still in the picture? How are companies like WWE going to adapt and adjust to AEW? Are they going to be a similar way like they did with WCW in the late 1990s? Will there be a counterpunch? We talk about all of that and more on The Good, The Bad, and The Hungy every week on the Voices of Wrestling Network.
Love Japanese pro wrestling? Want coverage of the entire scene, men's and women's promotions, from New Japan to Stardom, NOAH, All Japan, DDT, Marigold, Gold, and more? Then Wrestling Omakase is the podcast for you. Hosted by a 23-year Puro Watching veteran, that's me, John Carroll, and a rotating cast of co-hosts, we bring you a passionate, knowledgeable look at the wide world of Japanese wrestling. Wrestling Omakase is right here on the Voices of Wrestling Network. Check us out on any podcast app or feed today.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
You like pro wrestling, well, we like pro wrestling too. This week on Shake Them Ropes, in the news, nothing, not a damn thing has happened this week. In the lazy river of wrestling criticism, ice cold takes on Night of Champions, and AEW decides to do their 300th episode. An Invader Club, a first for us from MLW. Jacob Fatu versus LA Park. My choice. I'm Jeff Hawkins. He's Chris Novembrino. And yes, Chris. There is no news this week.
No. So I can open up with a little banner. Yesterday, I played my second and final gig with one of the strangest human beings I've ever played with. I had taken this first gig, months ago. It's at a trailer park retirement home here in Albuquerque. Yeah, right. So the first time we were set up outside, and it was fine. It did result in one of the strangest blues jams that I've ever participated in, where it was the end of the set, and it was definitely what killed the set too. We were all done after that one, because the drummer just refused to find the downbeat. So the entire time we have bump, but dot, but dot, but the bass is not agreeing with where the kick and the snare are, and they're never on one, and it was the strangest thing in the world. I just started taking a solo, and even that, I was having a hard time anchoring down to any sort of notes or time. I was just sort of doing an Eddie Van Halen freewheeling. Well, if there's no timing here, I'm just gonna go for dazzle, and we'll just see if any of the shit lands. Sort of thing. Went to dazzler mode, which is not my preferred move. It's the desperation. I don't know what the hell else is going to work, so I'm just going to play fast shit and see if any of it lands. Sort of thing. So yesterday, I get called back to do the 4th of July here once again at the beautiful trailer park/retirement community here in Albuquerque. And this time, they stage us inside, which the second I hear this, the second I hear this, I know that this is going to be bad because they're old people. They have hearing aids. I'm looking at this stage, and this stage is kind of shotgunny. So lots of like outward projection, which would be cool, except that like all of these people are going to complain. Now I should mention, what type of songs do we play here at this show, Chris, other than that weird blues jam? Well, that's
did you play
Mott
the Hoople? I was hoping you
no,
would play Mott
the
Hoople.
That's
this
where
week.
This gets real fun, Jeffrey. Yesterday, our first song was 25 minutes of four chords that this gentleman plays. That I have to try to make it make sense to the bass player and our saxophone player, who's inexplicably there. And this first one, this first 25-minute jam goes, okay. You know, we make it make about as much sense as we can. It, weirdly, the four chords he plays sounds like the section of one of my own songs if it had been beaten mercilessly with a shovel in the dead of night by two people who are very angry at it because it owed it money. So I was able to make it make sense based on that fact. But then we get told for the first time, but not for the last time, to turn down. Now, the volume, dude, I'm in an old folks home. I already know that, like, we can't be rocking it or whatever. So the volume's already low. Like, essentially, we're already staging to the volume of this drummer. And we're even a little bit quieter than him because I already kind of just, you know, I've played shows before. I know how old people like to complain about the lead guitar, whether or not it's actually a problem. Just the presence of lead guitar is subversive to their old ways. Too much soloing, too freewheeling, too liberal in its nature. So we get to our second song, which was, again, four indeterminate chords for about 20 minutes. We get told to turn down a second time. Then play our third song, again, four more indeterminate chords from Bob, who, like, wanders around aimlessly as, like, the band has to hold down the fort because he doesn't really do anything.
Were you playing with the string cheese incident? What was that?
Dude, this man, you know, he is in his mid to late 70s, dresses up like New Mexico cowboy. And
a lot of fuchsia. In his
La Turquoise, the guitar Turquoise? Heavily, the most over gimmicked acoustic guitar I have seen in a
Hell
while.
Yeah.
Zia on there, turquoise inlays, like massive oversized bridge. Man can't play it a lick. I mean, just feeble playing on this. A $2,000 guitar and a $20 player, and we have. You know, we get to our set break here, and we've now turned down to the point where my master on my amp is sitting below one, which is to say, like, I am sub-audible. Like I'm actually laughably low. And then the guy comes up to me and he goes, so for this next song we go up, I want you to rock out, but I also need you to turn down. And I look at him and I go, which one would you like, Bob? Do you want me to rock out? Do you want me to turn down? He goes, I want both. I want both. And I'm like, okay. So at this point, my amp is now at 0.25 of 10. And, you know, he looks at me, he goes, go for it, Chris. And I subaudibly look, I look at him with this, like, my death stare of like, Bob, if we weren't on a stage right now and I wasn't wearing my guitar right now, I would be against the wall and go, what are you doing? Instead, I go, yep, it's the last time I'm doing this, Bob. I literally say that to him as I take the solo and I start doing the most like Marty McFly wailing solo with no volume. None at all, because you can't hear me. Yeah, so I am just, I even rolled down the volume on my guitar and I'm just like spooting out random notes on the instrument. Like, I'm like, is this what you want? Or are we happy now? Are we happy now? We get told to turn down again after that song. Then we get told to turn down yet again. I think you can see where this show is going. We get told to turn down for the seventh time. Seven, I was counting. To this point where, like, everyone on the stage after, you know, like, four or five is just staring at each other like, can we please leave? Like, can this show possibly be over? Our drummer Who, as I mentioned, was the shakiest part of this band. All the other musicians, too, not to impugn the innocent, were competent. Our drummer decides that he is going to... Jeffrey, you've heard the Beatles song, The End, where yes. Ringo starts... Yes. Have you ever imagined what it would be like if that solo was mangled by a grain thresher with John Bonham somehow thrown into the mix?
Is this a rhetorical question?
Like, I was listening to it, my eyes went wide as this drummer proceeded to play so loud that and this guy's like in his like 50s, 60s. Like, this is the oldest member of the band other than Bob.
How hard can it be? Because the lead singer of Maroon 5 knows how to play it. I saw that on the voice.
Dude, it was brutal. As I said, it was the solo from The End with none of the finesse and all of the volume of John Bonham.
Just a gorilla with two clubs, huh?
Yes. The bass player, myself, and the saxophone player all went out, and we were like, after we got shut down, and all of us kind of had this like, dude, I'm like, what the?
They're shutting us down.
I made the comment to Liam. I was like, if I had known that all we had to do, if I had known that we could have had this drummer do the drum solo from The End and it would have ended the gig, it was so obvious. It was the obvious cheat code right there. No, we got shut down 40 minutes early at the old folks' home, which she came up, I was actually, here's the thing that was killer. I was actually getting ready to walk the show. And she shut us down before I had the pleasure of actually just unwiring myself and leaving the stage, which I had already disconnected cords. And I was like, well, I'm done for the day. Because I had devolved to, on the last song, literally playing my guitar upside down, seeing if I could play chord shapes with like my hand upside down. I can. Apparently,
if no old folks were killed, was it really a gig at a retirement home? No.
I know. It was a shame. It was a shame.
Okay, so...
No deaths to report. Look, we have a light show today, Jeffrey, and you and I both know it. You know what I do want to do when you're ready? I want to circle back. I know you mentioned Night of Champions, cold takes. One thing we didn't get to really talk about in the last episode was sort of like, and now we have some hindsight on it too, the deployment of Saudi Arabia as like the weird heel motivator thing for like CM Punk and the whole CM Punk is a hypocrite. I mean, especially,
did we not talk about that last week? I thought we did.
We mentioned that we wanted to circle back to it. And I don't think we actually did.
Okay. My
thought was sort of, or maybe we did, but
we can just go into it now because it's a lazy river of wrestling criticism because the only news that happened were two speculative things that aren't probably true. One is Jonathan Coachman saying Britt Baker wants to go to WWE, where nobody talks to Jonathan Coachman, and Britt Baker ain't talking to anybody because she wants to keep her leverage. So she may want to go to WWE. That may be true. She ain't telling anybody jack right now. But
want to go to WWE is a statement that's probably true for, you know, 75% of the unsigned talent who are not currently with WWE, even if they have other contracts. Most of them probably would want to go to WWE if the money was right.
And the other story is Dave Meltzer and Brandon Thurston, both of whom I love to death, but they're both on this kick of trying to figure out how much WWE is lying about their Netflix numbers. And if the streaming numbers are really that high for Max, are more people actually watching AEW than Raw every week? And I'm here to tell you it doesn't matter because both have big time deals with their respective distributors. And one company is still selling out Raw and SmackDown every week and two nights worth of pay-per-views at stadiums. So any kind of narrative you're trying to get in there that's saying, well, There's a significant downturn in WWE's business.
A secret inversion in the numbers
will be I wouldn't go that far, but it's one of those things.
No, that's their argument, isn't it? It's like that for years. when we were watching all of this stuff under different metrics, we were seeing WWE do somewhere between 3-1 or 4-1 numbers relative to Dynamite on any given week. And I'm supposed to believe that secretly these numbers have inverted despite no apparent increased buzz around AEW product in the real world. And WWE's numbers seeming to be fine across the board and no sort of like clear erosive pattern. So
I would need to observe
both an erosive pattern by WWE and a growth pattern by AEW. And I don't see either of those at anywhere near the rate I would need to see them at to believe that there's an inversion narrative here. And I think good journalists sitting in their armchairs, absent their Excel spreadsheets, could put that one together. So I don't think going to some submetrics is actually the secret reveal here. I think a priori, Sherlock Holmes style, you know that that's effing bullshit.
I will defend it up until this point. I don't think as many people are watching Raw on Netflix as they used to because it's not on broadcast TV. And yes, the broadcast numbers are there. And yes, there was some report that said in May that more people are watching shows on streaming than they are over broadcast / cable TV. I will grant you that there are probably a ton of cord cutters out there that are watching the Max app and are watching AEW on Max. I will grant you that. I am just saying it doesn't matter if AEW beats Raw in the ratings because all those people who aren't watching WWE on Netflix are getting it through YouTube or through social media or however they want to follow it. And they're still buying tickets to events. And the moment you'll know there's a downturn in business is when they can't sell out a pay-per-view.
I would see that in the real world if that attrition was really happening.
Yes.
Where I think the Excel spreadsheets are failing some people who believe that all truth can be found in the numbers. I think that might be true, but if you don't have all the numbers, one really important number that I can't imagine how you'd get good measurements on is how many people are watching wrestling every week on watchwrestling.com or some other various website like that.
Yeah.
Right? And a move to Netflix, because you've now moved the platform to the internet, might nudge more people, especially if people have already been, you know, pirating and stuff. And I feel like most people know how to find free stuff on the internet these days. It's not that hard. And if you can't do it, well, Gumption's always out there, you know, and Google. So I think you don't have these great, maybe you don't have complete metrics. So then go back to your armchair. Swish this idea around in your mouth. And does it taste right? And it doesn't, because you just don't see AEW stepping up into that next tier of arena. They're not going from, you know, they're not going into the basketball stadium. They're not going into the football stadium. You don't see WWE moving down to the Civic Center.
Right.
You know, if anything, WWE's their numbers they feel are strong enough that they can run smaller B markets like Albuquerque and stuff like that with some confidence. You know, and AEW does that as well. I'm not saying they don't. I'm glad that everyone runs in Albuquerque. It has nothing to do with that. It's just I hear something like this, and before I ever need to poke around and look at numbers on this, I just go, does that feel like my lived experience? And if it doesn't, then, you know, what does that mean?
All right. Night of Champions. Look, first two matches I thought were very good. Cody and beating Randy and Rhea Ripley and Raquel Rodriguez in the street fight. I thought those were really good matches. Sammy and Karrion Kross, Solo and Jacob Fatu, where we finally got the debut of Hikuleo / Tala Tonga, were meh. Asuka got Jade Cargill over the finish line in that match, but it wasn't anything to write home about. And then this John Cena CM Punk match, which just left a bad taste about the entire show in my mouth because it was just overbooked mess.
This stunk.
I did like the thought of Seth cashing in on John Cena and what that would portray and stuff, but then it just went right back to John Cena putting on old stone face, trying to kick Punk in the balls, as opposed to any connection to, oh, I might be in actual danger here from Seth Rollins. And it's been talked about as if, okay, that was CM Punk's last chance to beat John Cena. I'm like, well, hold on here. wait, we're just going to in the narrative, it's like, well, that's one shot and that's it. It's like, why isn't Punk demanding a rematch for some reason or another? Okay, that's it, whatever. But you wanted to go into the bigger picture of CM Punk as a hypocrite, and I'm
hypocrite,
kind of,
right?
I'll listen to you.
Yeah, I mean, it's not something that keeps me up at night. Let's be clear about that. It's just like,
I think people have gone too hard into it a little bit, as if you know. And these are mostly people who front AEW a lot without saying, oh, just because it failed. I kind of want to say, hey, you remember when AEW was courting the government of China real hard?
you want to know my problem is with the hypocrite storyline?
What?
Is it was lame.
Yes. Oh, the storyline was lame.
Right. Storyline was absolutely lame. There's one problem of it's really hard to make a heel out of your business partner.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Even if
I'm focused in on what you're saying, because I thought this was more of the overall.
Deal with Saudi
Arabia versus the storyline. Now I'm locked in.
No,
go ahead.
Right. Yeah. So you need to make a heel out of your business partner. Let's be clear for Chris Novobrito speaking for himself. Yeah, Saudi Arabia is a heel. They are a bad actor. MBS, their monarchic bloodline regime that endorses the oppression of women and other things. They're bad actors. Oh, by the way, did I mention that they killed a journalist with a bone saw, which is the exact thing that CM Punk is referencing here when he's talking about the blood money with Saudi Arabia and everything. So, like, no, they are a bad actor. However, you're WWE. You've signed a contract in blood with this bad actor. So you can't really explain on your own programming why it might be that people think Saudi Arabia is a bad actor. I mean, hell, Saudi Arabia is so touchy about advertisement on their show that they don't even allow you to do all the mats and the Prime energy drinks and the other stuff too. You can't advertise Great American Beer for obvious reasons.
Slim Jim,
yeah, also haram. Any number of these things. So then you get stuck in this nether region of, like, we have this CM Punk storyline of, oh, he insults The Miz, and this is now a storyline on your show. He insults The Miz on Twitter about this thing. You brought this up on your show, this blood-soaked regime of Saudi Arabia, begging the obvious question for the viewer, why would CM Punk think they are blood-soaked? Again, you introduce this on your TV, so they either now have to Google it, I don't know that Saudi Arabia wants that, or you've got to somehow explain it. And explain that CM Punk was wrong, that the kingdom. So you have to move basically into profound, disgusting levels of shillery for Saudi Arabia, whitewashing the blood off of this regime, which, to WWE's credit, I will say, they did not go that route, leaving us into a nebulous realm of incoherence where we do not know why CM Punk thought that Saudi Arabia was so bad, this business partner of WWE. And we do not know why it makes sense that John Cena is now calling him a hypocrite for wanting to go over there and do this show and chase John Cena all the way over even into Saudi Arabia to have this match. And John Cena is the one who baited CM Punk into all of this stuff. So ultimately, you get to this very unsatisfying in between where Saudi Arabia is, in your kayfabe world, sort of this, like, bad actor that clearly, like at least to the American audience, are like the reason why CM Punk, the babyface in this storyline, is even open up to the criticism of hypocrisy because he said someone was bad, and now he's walking back on that belief that they're bad. But like our understanding of the hypocrisy, this is very important, is not that CM Punk falsely maligned Saudi Arabia, this good, wonderful bastion of freedom and liberty in the Middle East. And he slandered them. Oh, he slandered them. What a monster CM Punk was. That's not the vernacular understanding of what happened here. Is it that CM Punk called his shot, said, you know, bad is bad, spade's a spade, I'm calling my cards right here on the table. And he said that Saudi Arabia's got blood on their hands, and now he's being a wimp. Now he's being a sis. Now he's being this guy who used to be rock hard on his values, stand on your values no matter what, and he's waffling. The hypocrisy is the hypocrisy of waffling. And we all understand that implicitly. And that is the other kind of flaw here in choosing to deploy Saudi Arabia in the heels. Even if you're not willing to say why they're bad, everyone subtextually understands that the hypocrisy is you're calling a bad person a good person in a self-serving way because it's strategically advantageous. Not that you call, that you falsely slandered a good person as a bad person to serve yourself 3-4 years ago.
While you were talking, I had a thought.
Oh yeah, my thought wasn't interesting enough for you, so you had to come up with your own.
No. Just a comparison, because I realized what this is, and in terms of storytelling, this is an AEW storytelling trope, where this is almost what they did with Hangman and Punk, where it's, oh, everybody knows the background, but we're never going to mention it on TV. But we're going to put them in a match because everybody knows the background and they're going to be the feud. So everybody knows what's going on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
This is the same problem as Brawl Out. Yes. Deploying Brawl Out and all. Yeah, it's the same problem. It seems at first blush completely different because of the Saudi Arabia socio-political thing. But
yes.
Like, that's not where I'm choosing to go here.
I knew where you were going. The going is they don't want to tell us the story on TV because the backstage politics of it are far too difficult and actually expose the business.
Unflattering and damning.
Yes.
Right? So now you're stuck with like, we could still make money off of this.
Yes,
can you?
That's it. That's all that matters. We just need John Cena and CM Punk in the building. Who cares about the story? They're in the building, and that's all these dumb Saudi fans want is stars and for it to feel like a big WrestleMania type of moment type thing. And yes, it's much like the AEW fans who make up the story in their head that they've actually told it on the TV. Yeah, we'll put Hangman and CM Punk back in there for the world title, et cetera, et cetera. And it's right there. Yeah, no, it's we want to tell this story, and Punk is the problem here because Punk doesn't have a filter, but we still want to use that to make some money. That's what it is.
Yeah, right. We want to use this hypocrisy angle.
Yes,
but
we don't want to tell you why he's a hypocrite.
Right, we can't. It's not. Not only do we not want to, when we really think about it, it's actually a terrible idea. Shit.
This is actually a bad idea, but we still want to make the money off.
We're already like two beats into this. Yeah, right. No, I mean, you almost wonder after week one.
You know what that is?
They walk back and they're like, damn, this is dumb.
It's the third trilogy for Star Wars is what it is. It's this story absolutely stinks, but we want to use the fan service and the money off of it. And we still have two movies to go, but this absolutely sucks in every
or like the wreckage of Rian Johnson's episode 8. You're looking at going like, okay, how do we make this make sense?
Jonathan Majors is a bad person, but we still want to do all these crossovers for the Avengers, and we have more super movies, hero movies to go. How can we fix this somehow? I know. Let's just retcon the fact that Jonathan Majors was in any of these movies.
So, and make and, it... and, And to this point, the whole need to pivot off to Seth Rollins and everything, I think, is them going like, no, I think it's them going like, this storyline sucks. We need to hit the abort button as fast as possible. Like, I mean, I think there's a lot of money potentially in John Cena and CM Punk as a SummerSlam main event. And running away from this, which is the right move, is what they have to do now.
I thought for sure the moment Seth Rollins came out there, here it comes. We're going to turn John Cena babyface in this foreign country where they want something important to happen.
And they're completely right that they would completely – they would 100% give Cena the full babyface treatment.
Yes, because they were doing it all the time and during this entire
They wanted
angle.
To already. They wanted to already. They Yeah, exactly. Like, so, yes, I would have done The Rock's backstab here.
Yes.
And then had this open question for Cena, who now has no friends – and is now wondering if Rocky was out to screw him, and you have Heyman kind of out there alluding to it.
That, but not
the,
just that,
that. That the cash in was actually maybe coming from someone else other than Rollins and Heyman entirely.
And I said this last week, that's also how you fix the CM Punk as a hypocrite problem, is that you make him the hypocrite. And he's the guy in with Rocky right now because he's completely sold out to be Mr. TKO, just like John Cena said he was. And then it all comes full circle. But instead, I think they're going to go with Cody is going to be the heel. And I think that's I am not as – I think they have a good thing.
But no, this
is
– you're super right here on the hypocrisy storyline. Like, you – this is a, it's always that Chekhov's gun sort of thing that we like to argue. But it's important. If you're going to introduce the hypocrite
yes.
thing, you've got to pay that off somehow.
Yes.
You've got to make that make sense somehow. And as we discussed with Saudi, I'm not going to rehash it, rewind if you need that. Like, it didn't make sense that way. And a way of kicking out of this is proving that Punk is a hypocrite in a different way, which is that he's so desperate, and you can now sort of roll in, willing to appear in Saudi Arabia as part of this grander, look, dude, I just want the effing title so bad that I'm going to do whatever
yes.
Rock says.
Yes.
I'll go to Saudi, right? I am, you know what? I want it. I'm old. I want it. I want it one last time. I want it. I want it. I want it.
And we can connect this back to the Elimination Chamber story, where apparently Rock had Cena as his guy going into this, when he should have been making offers to Logan Paul, to Seth Rollins. I mean, he need to be the guy making deals with everybody, but like whoever the good guy was going to end up being in this whole thing. You know, let's put it this way, that he had multiple irons in the fire in case plan A didn't go well. And then he could do plan B. That's where you get that's where you get people coming in and going, okay, this story rules because it has layers to it and things like that. That's why when the bloodline started to fall apart, we loved it because like Drew McIntyre never lost his want.
He was always telling the truth. It's unfortunate that Drew's, you know, kind of like out of the scene right now, because he was great as the dick, like almost like this like meta commentary guy, the dick who was always telling the truth, and you didn't like him, but he was always telling the truth. You know, he was right about people.
Yeah. Sammy never really changed his stripes. Jimmy Uso never did either. He's still in the shadow of his big brother and still feels it every time he's out there. So, I mean, you had all those moving parts, but yeah. As for the other matches, SummerSlam's going to be interesting. That's all I'm going to say.
Right, yeah, that's all I'm going to say. And then, like, for me, beyond that, these Saudi shows, look, if you don't want to watch them for the politics reasons, I get that. But if you don't want to watch them because they're kind of boring, boy, I get that too. There is just a level of by the numbers, you know, we are just here to, we're basically glorified house show for a kingdom. It's a palace show, you might call it.
What happened was, like, they got mad that it wasn't they wanted a WrestleMania style event. And so they wanted big things to happen. At first, they wanted big stars. And then they wanted big things to happen, so they made up this King and Queen of the Ring finals in here where you get something for SummerSlam. They're going to amp it up for Royal Rumble, I think. I think Royal Rumble will be what the Saudis really want, which is, you know, a mainstream.
Well, they want something that's like not basically just a house show that can be sort of written. Yeah, because right now they, and I understand why WWE's done this, and WWE's been really clever with how they've navigated
They've been a little too clever by half, I think, at times too about it, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Look, they like the deal, but they also like the idea of the deal a little bit behind the curtain. Like, they don't want you paying too much attention to the fact that they have a business partner that is a blood-soaked regime.
I think they're very aware that the politics of this can go south at any time.
Yep. Right. No, and I'm right. You know, like, that's the other thing. It's like, I mean, look, you only need to open up the newspaper periodically over the last 5 years to see any number of different headlines that might shake up a WWE executive as he's checking out the politics of the Middle East and how this might affect their business partner, Saudi Arabia. And, like, yeah, they want to be WWE. They want to be World Wrestling Entertainment, but there are lots of other countries in the world that are peaceable and do not run the potential of going to war in a region at any given moment. And while WWE loves this money, they also, I think, are aware that this money does come with a non-zero risk.
So the follow-up Raw was in the afternoon on Monday. They taped both that and SmackDown to get through the week, to give guys a week off, because next week, if you like wrestling, it's going to be great for you. If you're like me and your podcast, it's going to be kind of unbearable at times. We have the Great American Bash. We have Saturday night's main event. We have Evolution on Sunday. And then we have AEW's All In on Saturday. Now, from the Raw, I liked Judgment Day and New Day, even though it was heel versus heel. It was obvious one group was kind of playing babyface a little bit. It was a banger of a match. I liked Rusev and Sheamus. I thought Sheamus is getting into that LA Park style. I'm just here to have hard-hitting, badass matches occasionally. I'm not here for the world title, but I'm going to give you a slobber knocker type thing on a Monday night. And I found Lyra versus Bayley somewhat disappointing, but
Lyra just continues to not get there in terms of attachments, in terms of storytelling. I think her promos kind of stink.
Well, Bayley being put in there makes it kind of a big match. And the problem is Lyra is kind of like, Lyra's getting there. Like, she's getting better on her promos. I think her work in ring is great.
Oh, I think she's a great worker.
It's just one of those things where it's like, yeah, it's like, Lyra, you're really good. But man, Bayley and Becky, that's something. And we want to see that. And you're just kind of here right now in the way of it. I understand you were screwed by Becky. I understand you have a thing of it. But Bayley was screwed before you decided to be Becky's tag team partner type of a thing. So let's just kind of backtrack and go to that story and see this one-on-one thing before we get you back involved in it. And I think fans have kind of moved ahead of the feud, so to speak. What do you think of Judgment Day and New Day? What did you think of it?
I liked that because
I really did.
I like the way that the Judgment Day post-Priest has been handled. Mm-hmm. I think that the Judgment Day this is... Let's not forget that this was Edge's crappy faction that got turned into one of the premium factions on Raw, like through just an unbelievable redemption arc. Crappy name, crappy music. It all kind of sucked. Generic black crap, as their clothing
and
look.
That first theme was terrible, by the way. It had kind of like that nasally metalcore dude singing whatever, and you're just like, oh, this is terrible. I hate this so much.
There's another issue with like wrestling theme songs right now where they have felt like They have felt like AI music anticipating AI music for a minute here, where they don't necessarily feel they're not. Wrestlers are just getting handed a theme song rather than theme songs being written to fit that gimmick. And it shows. It absolutely shows. Sometimes I will have my back turned and hear a theme song, and I have no idea who it attaches to. I'm a musician. But you know what I mean, Jeff? Like, think of, like my brain, and you know me specifically, like my brain can't not process music if it's kind of happening in the background even. Like, it's got to be quiet for me to focus in on speech, because like my brain gets into chord changes and stuff and memorizes the dumb chord changes from commercials and shit. I cannot tell. Like the WWE theme songs, and AEW has this too, where like I have my back turned and it has that same AI music effect where I do not get, I could tell you chords that are happening, but it's not, no memory is formed. You know, like it's like, well, remember that time you heard G to E minor, Chris? Well, yeah, sure. When? Like, you know, there's just nothing.
I think every single time that they've look, I know people hated CEO or CFO, whatever the name of that duo was that was doing things.
Yeah, look, CFO.
But I'm telling you, it's an upgrade to whatever they evolved to, because there is no bigger upgrade in the past year and a half other than CM Punk doing Cult of Personality, which is a real recognizable song, than them going back to Asuka's original theme from You Can't Hide to The Future. That everything about Asuka's first theme from the brown, you know, the first chord that signals doom.
And then
that next thing where it's like everything about that just screams death is coming to the ring, and it's so good, and I'm so glad they went back to it. Yeah, pay those people. Like, I hated when they remixed Sasha Banks' theme.
Yes.
I thought that was a downgrade, look, too.
CFO, you know, another option here, right, is rather than just retaining one team to write all of the theme songs. I mean, I think that's part of the problem here.
Yes, it's an in-house type thing, and it's right, not the 50s, you know, anymore what was the name of the Brill Building, I think, in New York?
Yeah, right, the Brill Building. I mean, but like even in the 90s, you had Jim Johnston in there, and he was basically just churning these bad boys out or whatever. You don't even have to get name bands, but get different bands to write different songs for different wrestlers. Maybe have one mastering service so they all can be mastered for the arena volume and everything like that. But getting different flavors of bands in there will help get these wrestlers to have more personality too. This happened so badly, I think, for the mid-card women wrestlers in WWE.
Yes.
Their theme songs are the most interchangeable pieces of crap. Like it's some high thingy and then a dance beat. I'm right, actually, aren't I?
Yeah,
it's always some high thing. And then and it might be a different high thing. It's not always. It might be. But that just
is
that
it,
one
is
line
worse
repeats.
Hold on. Is it worse for WWE mid-card women or mid-card men in AEW?
Mid-card men in AEW will have generic rock theme four. You know, like early 2000s rock theme. It makes. Seriously, AEW, it's like, dude, they need Dale Oliver from TNA. I don't know what they were paying him, but they should just pay that guy, because that's clearly the music they want. And Dale Oliver wrote better theme songs for TNA than AEW's getting.
Than Mike Ruckus's? I mean, Mike Ruckus has a few good ones, I think. I think, like
he has a few good ones, but then he has there are moments, like, I think Hangman's theme is a good piece of music, but it's a strange piece of music for whatever the character is.
Yes.
Like, when the character that Adam Page is doing right now does not fit that music. That music is for a cowboy who for a guy who's completely lost his soul in a desperate chase for a title.
It's like, right. it's sad emo it's whining. Cowboy.
Yes, yeah, no, but it's...
I think they're going to go back to the original...
mustache twirling villain.
Yeah, I think they're going back to the original theme for All In. I think you'll be happy about that one.
Well, I mean, bump, that one's not bump. Bad.
Yeah, the bouncy one where he came out.
Yeah.
Because he's still kind of coming out from the heel tunnel, I think. So...
Does that still matter? The tunnels?
I still pay attention to it, but nobody else does. NXT or AEW's 300th? Which do you want to go to? And I'll let you start, since I blabbed around a bit. Because this NXT was nothing. But
I know, but like... I mean, if you're asking me... like...
Let's get AEW out of the way.
AEW is the answer for me. I would go to AEW. It's over NXT. Because NXT stinks so bad. But if you're asking me, thinking about these shows over 300, NXT's obviously had better NXTs, in my
opinion.
Let's do
this.
Like, the best NXTs are better than the best Dynamites.
Let me make a deal with you then, because we'll do this like a term paper. We did the main roster first. Let's go with our weakest point second and go with the second strongest last, and then we can go through. So let's just get NXT out of the way here. Do you want to start? I offered it to you, but I mean, I have
Look, the thing I like on NXT right now is Tatum Paxley. She is a very, very talented wrestler.
Yes.
They need to get her out of this stupid gimmick, but God, she's... Here's a question for you, Jeff. If you had to look at the women's roster on NXT right now, does Tatum Paxley fall below top five? Because I couldn't get there. I couldn't put five wrestlers in front of her. I was trying to.
I might have her top two. She is
she might be. She's so good.
I wrote you this week. This was the week where I'm all in on Tatum Paxley. Watching her in that match... And also, not just the wrestling stuff, but the acting stuff, as we like to call it. She is fantastic. There are two women I'm going to talk about this week. Her and Thea Hale. Because I thought Thea Hale had a hell of a week, even though she lost that match in a stupid way on NXT. And she kind of lost the match on speed, which was better than it should have been. But she was in there with someone who was really good. But Tatum Paxley this week, I'm watching her sell. I'm watching her how she's interacting with Izzy Dame. I'm watching how crisp she is on, like, coming off the top with that cross body. She is so good. And
offense,
she is in such a...
selling, locomotion generally throughout the ring.
Yes.
It's all at a very, very high level. You and I both kind of, I've been heavy. She's just
She's
always shown these flashes of talent that have been just like a cut above, especially for me. It's always been the locomotion. Some people, Lash Legend's a good example of this. I'm always very down on her. Part of it's Lash Legend's locomotion in the ring is lousy and has always been. She takes too many steps going off the ropes. The ring does, she does not seem to know how to fit in the ring. The ring does not, you know, whatever it is. Tatum Paxley, she looks like she knows how to move in that ring perfectly. She knows the width of steps, the amount of everything. There's never like an extra step or whatever. It's just, it's always been there. And yeah, man, like I want her to get out of this gimmick. I want her to get, like, we need to get back to JC Jane versus Tatum Paxley with this whole, like, when JC hated Tatum thing.
I would even, boy, I know they're doing a tag team for Evolution, but it's too late for it because, but I would make Tatum Paxley and Thea Hale a team. That first brush of offense where Thea Hale comes out like the friggin' Ultimate Warrior and just her engine is, I forget the name of the redhead who's doing the Alabama Southern gimmick. Lainey Reed.
She's not bad at all.
But Thea Hale just continuing with the motor running, doing all that offense with her as a base. I watched that. I go, how have they lost the thread with Thea friggin' Hale? And then I watched her versus Kaylee Ray on speed. And that was, you know, 3 minutes of just going at a high clip between the two of them and Kaylee Ray or Alba Fire.
Fire. Sorry, yeah, I know. Yeah,
I hate that name. Go back to KLR.
I do too. I mean, especially now that she's like the Secret Hervis. Also, like that joke's lame now. Like Secret Purpose.
I still love
Secret
that. Purpose I love them
was
both.
A, was a better joke.
They are so good at it, though. They are so good at the suit thing and playing Secret Service and crap like that. But
no, I agree.
I agree
great.
With you.
Yeah.
But Thea Hale, man, you're just watching her, and just she just has. She has everything you want if WWE wasn't that territory that always tells those types of wrestlers to slow down, you know, because that's what they do with all the flyers and all the speedy people. Hey, slow down, kid. Make every move mean something. But with Thea Hale, that's the whole point of the frenetic offense is that it's frenetic and then she catches you with six moves in a row and pins you. And then you're like, what the hell happened? Because I wasn't expecting that type of thing. It's like in the NCAA that really good defensive team that gets caught by the run and gun crew, and all of a sudden they're down like by 30 points, and you're like, what the hell happened? I thought they were good lockdown stuff. Yeah.
The Jimmer for debt. All we do is take ridiculous amounts of threes team or whatever from back in the day.
Yeah, the Gonzaga team from Jimmer.
Gonzaga. Yeah. Right. I think cadence remains an issue, right? Like certain wrestlers need to have a match style that fits their character. Otherwise the match cadence begins to undermine the quality of the gimmick.
Yeah.
Like if you're going to have Thea Hale, explosive house of fire, she cannot get stuck into a slow down in the mire sort of thing
with Jada Parker type of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's got all, I mean, and her matches sort of have to be like an all or nothing.
Yes.
Like they should always be.
That
sprints.
Would be great. That would
right.
be great.
They should, they should always be sprints where it's either Thea Hale goes out there and like the explosion of Thea Hale absolutely wipes out their opponent or her opponent. Or the explosion of Thea Hale, like the opponent's able to weather the storm and get the pin because, you know, Thea's going to do eight moves. And if you can hang on that ninth move, she's going to make a fatal error. Like you can't make that many moves without making mistakes.
And that thing sucks too, by the way.
Right. No,
she's yelling. I'm a grown ass woman. It's
oh
like,
my God. That's the other thing I wanted to know. I am so sick of the WWE trope of guy or girl says ridiculous non sequitur line that's supposed to establish some degree of characterization, but the line's not even like something you could put on a t-shirt. Like, I'm a grown ass woman, Thea Hale, or my life, my rules, Lexus King. Like, these are not even t-shirt slogans. So then why the hell are we saying them every time this guy comes out the curtain before we hear the first notes of their song? Is my life, my rules really stronger than whatever the first note of that song is? And the answer is yes, but that's only because it's a shitty song.
He's dead.
Lexus yeah, oh, King. Yeah, no. Right, no, and it does, honestly... It doesn't help when Graves constantly craps on his appearance. You know, I will say I continue to enjoy NXT's commentary team. You know, if you're asking me NXT's commentary versus AEW Dynamite's commentary. No, I know. NXT's is great because the Vic and Corey hating Booker thing is entertaining. It's hating Booker's extreme incompetency.
I think Vic had a moment like in the first 3 minutes where he's like, pace yourself. You have another hour, 2 hours to go or something like
that. Yes. There were a couple of really funny lines directed at Booker.
Yes.
Like that becomes a match within a match, which like, is not great commentary, but I'm entertained and that works for me.
Yeah, but that's hate watching in a way. I don't.
Yeah, but that's Jeff. It's a B show. You got to remember this. The commentary standards are different on the B show. The A show, I need called really, really well. The B show, I need the commentary team to be entertaining. And I will say this: NXT, if I was rating them on a Raw rating, they stink. on a B-show WCW Saturday Night rating. Okay. Dusty yeah. Rhodes, he got a bicycle daddy. Like, no, he got a bicycle daddy, a good on Raw. But on Saturday Night, hell yeah, let's go. I've been smoking weed. Like, I need he got a bicycle daddy's where I'm at.
I have two quick ones. Number one, Joe Hendry is entirely mid to me. I don't see it anymore. I think his gimmick is great. But then the bell rings and I just go, he has some size to him. He has a little bit of power, but he's purely.
The choke slam so undermining because it's like, yes. He does it and it feels goofy and comic booky
yes.
and like narrative shattering for me. Cause it's like, dude, I guess professional wrestling, but like it's like close to like Santino Marella doing a choke slam on like 6'5" guys or something.
Yeah, and it's yeah, also you know, the, like the oh,
hey, he's got the.
Go yeah. ahead, sorry. The we will the, rock he,
we
you,
will rock you. Yeah, also
that,
lame.
That also Emi Sakura does much better in my opinion. Even though I found Emi Sakura coming out in a mustache, weird, but yeah, and
not
but
the first time she's done that, but it's still weird.
But Inamura is awesome.
That, I loved him.
He's great.
I love him. I thought, look, I thought this match had problems, and I'm going to get to those, but...
Yeah, it's mostly...
Jasper working. Troy and Inamura, I think when it was working, it was working. I thought I liked the physicality. It's just,
yes.
Again, when now we get back to kind of a classic Chris trope of, like, wrong type of match, man. Inamura needed to really come in here and have... Jasper Troy on his heels.
Flummoxed.
Like, oh, yeah. Flummoxed. Right. You know, like that Troy has been running through other people. But now all of a sudden, when he tries to do this, and he thinks he's going to do this on this littler guy, but here is Inamura, who is a Japanese brick shithouse. And you're trying to like clubber on him. And he's just like, no, warrior spirit. Here, you know, let's get a little bit of this. And then he starts laying into Jasper Troy, who is a big, tough rookie. And now Jasper Troy's in there against a seasoned, veteran,
yes.
adult man.
God,
and,
yes.
and right? And that's ultimately what prevails here. It's the difference between a tough, gritty rookie and a man in his prime who has 10 years under his belt. He's not old. He's not young. He is a true veteran, and he is seasoned and tough and has a seasoning and toughness that only comes with 10 years of working in the ring.
And it never comes to fruition in WWE.
Nope.
That happens because
they don't
know
how to tell that story.
We want to protect our big guy who's going to be a future star because we made him the winner of LFG or whatever. And instead of just getting the – and also because there's always that weird thing about them, they still remember the Matt – was it Matt Capitelli? Was that the name? When
or Bob Holly put, like waylaid him?
When, yes, when Bob Holly and the other guys just took advantage of him, and they never want to kind of put that on screen, even in a kayfabe sense type of thing. But
which is okay. So then that I mean that might very well be true, and then that fundamentally misunderstands the problem with the Matt Capitelli Bob
yes,
Holly thing,
yes,
which was
yes.
This was not even
no
because then there were some other ones too. Where they had Capitelli have the get the shit kicked out of you experience with Benoit Guerrero and Bob Holly, that also happened. But
they did with Husky Harris in a Rumble, I think, too, before he became.
Yeah, yeah, I know. There have been a few of these. It was the guy who tried to do that on Angle, who tried to tap Angle. That guy, they punished.
Oh, I know who you're talking about. I can't remember that.
Daniel Tudit.
Pewter.
Daniel Pewter. There we go.
Pewter.
Yes. Yeah, and Pewter got the Bob Holly, Guerrero, Benoit treatment, I think. And, like, I get all of that, but this is not what we're calling for here.
No, we're asking for him to be in deep water.
A kayfabe experiential
yes.
setback.
Yes.
Where, oh, dude, you come in, you know, this is just the truth of talented young people at any level. You come in, you're very talented, but like every young, talented person, there's a lot that you know. But to borrow some terms from a former Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, there are things that you don't know that you don't know. And you have these experiences that show you what you don't know. So now you know what you don't know. But you have to have the only way you can go from not knowing what you don't know to knowing what you don't know is by having an experience. It's right. Yeah, it's not, you know, you can't. That's the act of discovery is going to be through experience. And so it is completely coherent to me that a guy like Jasper Troy would have this moment of, oh, I didn't know that could happen, because he's new. He's hot. He's talented. But he goes for a big shoulder block and runs his ass into a pole and realizes, oops, maybe you don't fully commit to a big move on the outside. Otherwise, you dislocate your shoulder. Lesson learned. You know, the noob mistakes. It's a story that can be told.
Yeah, in the NBA, it's the college defensive player of the year coming in for his first game, not necessarily against Michael Jordan, but against a guy
who's a seasoned
veteran and could put up some points. And you realize, oh, it's a different level of play up here, as opposed to, oh, I was a big fish in a small pond down there type thing. And there's nothing wrong with telling that story. It's just they always want to protect their big men because, again, remember, Vince thought David and Goliath was booked improperly.
Booked wrong. Yeah, no. And this, so much of this then circles back to commentary just needs to get this over. You need to, one, in the agenting of this match, have a couple of rookie mistake beats pre-scripted. So, like, you know, yeah, obviously you don't have to script every suplex, but, like, you have a couple of set pieces in this match to exhibit that Jasper Troy makes some rook mistakes. Miscalculation, underestimating your opponent early on in the match, and then overcommitment on a big move. Maybe you go for a big clothesline off the top ropes. And then what's really important is commentary highlights, points this out, and then explains at the end of the match that, you know, you have three key pieces, a mistake in the beginning, a mistake in the middle of the match, and a mistake to lose the match finally. And commentary puts over those three key beats in the recap.
AEW.
I mean, I don't have anything deeper than that. Yeah.
No. You were good. No, your point was great, and I didn't need to add anything to it.
Yeah.
Yes, AEW decided to celebrate their 300th episode of Dynamite by not saying anything about the past 299 episodes. Is always nice. I don't understand.
It is very tough to do a recap package when a lot of it just serves as an advertisement for the other channel.
Yes, two of your bigger stars are now big stars in the other company. Yeah. But I hate that. I hate, we're going to celebrate this metric, but we're not going to. I mean, it serves as a nice reset period at times to tell you what this company is all about. And oddly enough, the show itself kind of told you what it's all about. It's a little bit about snowflake hunting, as I like to call it. Let's put on some bangers and get high number of star ratings that the sickos will then be able to put in their spreadsheets and do it. I liked the show. I thought there was some good building for the angles. But at the same time, you know, you have two angles. I mean, the good that you did in the Hangman stuff with Moxley, which I thought was good. I won't call it great, but it was good. I'm going to give you time to give you your thought out here, because I want to know what you thought of the Marina Shafir taking the buckshot, because oddly enough, I was uncomfortable with it, and I'd usually not.
Yeah, no, I'll write it down.
Okay. The problem is you're going to have to kill me for that program. And then you do Kevin Knight and Speedball Mike Bailey trying to get into this tag title feud with the same, you're going to have to kill us to beat us, when they just come in, they kill them every friggin' time. Death in wrestling does not belong there. And I get the Cool Hand Luke versus Dragline build of get beat down, keep getting back up and show the people that you can do it. But at the same time, Mike Bailey and Kevin Knight, if they pull an upset in this tag title match, who cares? Because they've got their ass beat for 4 weeks now straight, and it looks like we're adding Nick Wayne and Christian into this feud too, based on the spoilers from Collision. By the way, yes, that's how the Kevin Knight versus Shelton Benjamin one-on-one is going to go down tonight. It's Nick Wayne inserts himself, and Kevin Knight pins Nick Wayne. The floor is yours, sir.
Okay, so Marina Shafir, we've discussed at length the narrative problems around here. I want to discuss my issue with her in this particular spot. I have no problem with a female heel figure getting comeuppance in professional wrestling. Professional wrestling has a long legacy of this. Baby Doll gets hers.
Yes.
Woman with the Four Horsemen gets hers. And I think that we can still do these moments in 2025. Really, Chris? Yes. Yes, I do.
We actually have that moment kind of in Invader Club.
Yeah, but there are rules around this.
Yes, there are.
There are rules around this. And a lot of them center around the idea that the female heel manager figure needs to be hoisted by her own petard.
Right.
That one, everything happens kind of as a reactive, defensive, very bang-bang sort of series of plays. That the series of plays that results in the female getting her comeuppance are initiated by her. I'll give you an example. Marina Shafir, or whoever it is, slides in a steel chair to the heel talent that she is managing. Heel talent has the steel chair. He is going for the kabong, and the babyface ducks because, like, who's going to take a steel chair to the head? Doesn't even realize that the woman is behind her, and boom, she gets kabonged. Now, yes. You know, like, right, that sort of moment, right? We need to have things like that. The problem with this, for me, was multifold. One, we have Adam Page, the babyface, really taking advantage of, like, dying fish Marina Shafir, who has to, like, fish flop sell in the ring. Ah, where's the water? What am I going to do? You know, it reminded me a little bit of the time that the Acclaimed got sprayed in the shaving cream and they couldn't stand up to save their lives. You know, like, Marina Shafir is fish flopping around in the ring, like, completely discombobulated. No help coming. Yeah. And Adam Page is staring at her like a sicko, like the sicko in that meme cartoon, like, buckshot, buckshot, buckshot. Now, meanwhile, as we are watching Adam Page and all of us are getting to know what this sicko is fantasizing about doing, we have the four members of the Death Riders, all of whom, I might add, are men who purport to be, you know, tough, manly men who are tough, standing around watching this defenseless woman in the ring who is supposedly their friend. And they're like, oh, God, she's going to get clotheslined. Oh, the humanity. Oh, no. Ah, she's going to get clotheslined. How can this be? None of them move an inch. You cannot measure it with a ruler how close Claudio Castagnoli or John Moxley get to the ring to save this person, making them all seem like profound cowards as she gets spread. Like, it's not even like they went to make the save and couldn't get there in the nick of time because it all happened so fast. No, they had time to fully process this. In fact, the lingering in the agony was the point. This was the knife we were twisting. Oh, I'm about to hit her. I'm going to hit her in the face. I am so about to hit your friend who's a woman in the face. And they're all like, oh, no, don't do that. Oh, if only I could do anything. If only I, Claudio Castagnoli, stood 6'4" tall and had raging biceps and abs. If only I was strong enough, not a small, feeble man standing 5'2", barely able to walk or move. Like, dude, it made them... We talk often about, like, they're supposed to be this big, tough faction. It's not that Adam Page pulled one over on these four tough guys. These four tough guys look like feckless, spineless cowards.
Okay. I agree. And especially after what looked like a pretty good kick and punch beatdown of Adam Page, he just kind of gets back up without feeling anything, and it once again kind of gets to the fact that Claudio Castagnoli looks like Tarzan but hits like Jane and then runs like Cheetah. Is the point possibly, Chris, and this is me thinking about the AEW fan who's just seething at this podcast right now. It's a possibility that the whole point is that the Death Riders are hypocrites and cowards like that, and that the ops were just so intimidating that they dare not try and fight Shibata, Joe, and Hobbs to get to their friend. And the fact is that they're not friends, really. That they're just kind of in a mutual criminal enterprise where there is no honor among thieves.
They've never sold that with anything other than Will or Yuta.
You are exactly correct.
I mean, that's the problem with that is that's fine. If it's Wheeler Yuta in the ring, and then you can pivot back to Jon Moxley saying something like, I'm toughening you up, kid. Or, you know, all the shit that he said after the Danielson
Moxley should be throwing Yuta to the wolves trying to get Marina.
Right, yeah, if anything, he's like, what are you doing? Go!
Why do I have you people as henchmen if you won't be henchmen?
Here's get a steel chair. Go. Get in there. Right. Exactly. Like, no, if anything, the obvious move here was, first thing you do is you send Wheeler Yuta to try to save her. And then when that doesn't work, Claudio and Pac roll their eyes and they all go down there to try to make the save. Like, maybe you have them do bad strategy or something like that, too. But they have never sold that the Death Riders is a disingenuous collective built out of circumstance. That they've always sold that the Death Riders are ideologically aligned guys who really share convictions.
Yes, we were forged in fire in the dojo of William Regal or whatever.
Right,
yeah.
Shared convictions. No, shared convictions has always been the thing with the Death Riders. So it's that works with the Callis family. Right? Like, you know, the Don Callis family, you completely believe that, you know, okay, these are all guys who are aligned based on contracts because they look like, you know, Don Callis is just signing anyone from the free agency bin that he can find. You know, Lance Archer and Takeshita, and here's some guy with a helmet. You know, like
Etchaceros in there,
Here's a luchador. I don't have a helmet guy, now I do. I didn't have a luchador, now I do. I need a tall guy. Here comes Lance Archer.
He's casting for type.
Yeah, right. He's just Like I believe that none of these people are truly friends. I believe that none of these people are ideologically aligned, other than we signed a contract. That's not what you're doing with the Death Riders. And the Death Riders has, insofar as it's ever made any sense as a faction, it's been a faction motivated by ideology. We are cleaning up the weak, and we have a common goal of purging this company of the weak. And we all agree on who the weak people are. I mean, look, I guess if they had sort of laid any rail that Marina Shafir was maybe a weak link after the blood and guts match or something like that.
And especially after the Chris Statlander vignettes that have been teasing that Moxley is trying to recruit her.
Right? If they had laid some rail that she was a weak link, okay. But they haven't.
Right.
Yeah. She doesn't screw things up for them. She hasn't cost them any titles. She hasn't cost any key matches.
Yeah, and this is kind of like, I look for heat in my buildup for matches, and it satisfied that. I still, it's one of those things where I'm watching.
So there's
like,
another problem, right? Like, this is a comeuppance moment, and so this is actually a pressure release beat in a story. Baby doll getting hers at the pay-per-view, the big pie in the face, releases the pressure.
Marina should have gotten the buckshot at the pay-per-view.
Pay-per-view. That's a pressure release.
Yes.
That's not a build.
Yes, exactly. It's one of those things where it's like we are trying to do a Hangman's going to become a babyface redemption story. And him just kind of went, and the moment he started talking on the apron, I go, he's not going to buckshot the woman, is he? And he did. And you're just kind of like, all right, there's the guy.
This is the guy
who burned down a house. Okay. He burned down a house. And now he's just like, okay, he's the guy we cheer for. Yay.
No, like this has this like mid 90s. Oh yeah. We just went there. Yo. Sort of like energy
It was very ECW. Yeah. That's
we
the point
just
I brought
so
up
went
on.
There. You didn't think we'd go there and we went there. And it's like, okay. But like, going back to my criticism, it's beyond all that other stuff. You went with a pressure release valve on a heat building week. So explain to me how that makes sense. If you take out the babyface's beloved wife 2 weeks before the pay-per-view, now he's fighting like a house of fire. If you take out the heels, heel manager 2 weeks before, what, John Moxley's coming in there to avenge Marina, and that's how we're building heat for this pay-per-view? Yeah, that's exciting. That's going to put butts in seats, to quote Tony.
Do you have anything else for this Dynamite? Because it's mostly good matches, and it's like, yeah, these like, don't get me wrong, I didn't love as much as other people, but like the Mina Shirakawa Mercedes match, Mercedes is great. Watching Toni Storm kind of be catatonic after doing the whole thing with Rachel Brosnahan was kind of weird for me, but you know, and like
Toni Storm was like weird in like, yeah, right, like that little beat afterwards. This is super minor, but the hell are you doing having a cake and no one's getting the cake in the face? I'm sorry, but like Chekhov's gun here again. Just put the cake in Luther's face. You brought the cake out there. It's a pallet cake. It's like they threw champagne in his face because they didn't want to do the cake again. Oh yeah, we just went there. Like, yeah, oh, you really subverted expectations, but like, okay, cool. Good job, guys.
I mean, the four way was a chance to get subvert expectations, and they just went right with chalk in terms of MJF being number two.
Right. I mean, this would have been a great opportunity for MJF to screw up and start the MJF screwing up. That like this whole him trying to like essentially he's a pretender to the throne of the Hurt Business. I think the much more intriguing story now is that he wants to be one of them, but he's not as good as them. Yeah. And that's the point. Okada versus Ibushi, by Okada TV standards, this was like a 3¾ star match. But like, I have to beg the question, why are we doing Okada Ibushi as just like a TV buildy sort of match?
Yes,
thing?
Well, see, that's just the thing. Okay, he beats Ibushi clean as a sheet. And the whole point is to then get to the post-match beatdown so that Kenny can make the save. But what you should really be doing is having Okada try and hurt Ibushi to send the message to Kenny Omega. And instead, they're just having a really good match because we liked that mid-teens New Japan stuff, and it's eschewing the story for work rate.
It's so important. That's so important. And it's the same thing we were talking about with NXT. Tell the right story for the angles that you're telling. If anything, these kind of classic pairings are a great opportunity to invert expectations. People come in thinking, oh, we're going to get like an Okada Ibushi kind of mid last decade sort of main event, flashback 10 years. And instead, Okada does something really dastardly right at the beginning of the match. You're like, oh, I would actually build the whole show like we're going to be kind of like, you know, flashing it back. And then the second the match begins, we just start destroying that allure.
Do you know how much goodwill AEW would lose by doing something like that? I mean, we'd love it because it'd be like, yes, we're going to have you know what that is? That's the AJ Styles Nakamura WrestleMania build. That's exactly what that is, where it's like, we're going to get the dream match. This is the dream match. We're getting the dream match. And then Nakamura kicks him in the balls, or AJ Styles kicks Nakamura in the balls.
Well,
and everybody goes, boo!
No, I wouldn't. I mean, I wouldn't go that, you know, like, but the other big difference there, too, is this is the dream match, and then, like, Nakamura doesn't just, like, go heel during the – it's not even like we get a turn mid-match. We just – that, you know, the dumbest possible version of a heel turn, you know, like
– yeah, that's true.
If you asked a 7-year-old, like, how does someone go heel? He goes, well, they kick the other guy in the balls. Well, yeah, like, they're right, but
– I mean, the whole point of this – I mean, we had the Callis family out there. And they waited until after the match to attack Ibushi, which was dumb. I mean, look, this whole point is we're trying to send a message to Kenny Omega, kind of a thing that, yeah, you know, the Callis family is once again coming after you, et cetera, et cetera. Look what we did to your friend. You know, whereas every single time this happens, it's usually Michael Nakazawa, who nobody gives a crap about, getting beat up. But it's like, oh, well, we got the hug from the Golden Lovers. Well, that's nice. You know, right. And Trent, This is the other thing that's been driving me crazy.
Oh my God.
Trent with the crowbar waiting for him to turn around. It's like, and Marina did the same thing with the briefcase. It's like, why are you, just hit him in the back. Hit him in the back. And then that'll start the beat. No, we got to wait for the turnaround so that people can block it. And it's just
dude,
like,
Trent's incapacity with the weapon is actually a gimmick and a lore killing. Because at least Sean Spears, when he was the chairman, would actually deliver big, meaningful chair shots occasionally.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, they got that over by making some of his chair shots devastating. Like, Trent Beretta, named after a weapon, can't use one.
And this is the second week in a row where Trent Beretta's promising violence and he doesn't deliver. Because remember, they're talking to the Young Bucks. It's like, hey, watch this. I'm going to go make an example out of him. And then he gets beaten in like a 3.5-4-star match. And you're like, ah, that boy, that showed him. Nice snowflake.
I want to start a GoFundMe to buy Kenny Omega a pair of not bizarre mom jeans.
Well,
like just a pair, just a pair of average, basic, normal fitting Levi's. Come out in a t-shirt and reasonable fitting jeans and we're good. And I'm someone who likes a skinnier cut. I just need them to not be this weird mom jean. I've been divorced. And now I'm getting back out on the town. Ladies, I'm single and ready to mingle. I'm 48.
As opposed to, say, shorts and Crocs that he's usually coming out in.
It's shorts, Crocs, or mom jeans.
His wardrobe is the worst.
It's the worst. Like, his gimmick is just, it's such a.
His gimmick is, I don't care because I'm not in Japan.
Yes, if he wasn't Kenny Omega and all of this shit was just assigned to any other normal wrestler, it'd be like the most, we'd be making fun of it constantly. Like, he comes out with this, like, techno dance song. He dresses like an idiot. Like,
it's so,
the promos are awful.
I mean, everybody yells at Okada for coasting on reputation. And I'd like to just say that Omega has been cashing checks without putting much effort into anything except the occasional pay-per-view match for a long time. I mean, don't get me wrong. On pay-per-view day, Kenny clocks into work. Don't get me wrong. He does. And he's great. And he never fails to disappoint. But it's one of those things where it's
Allen
Iverson.
When he's absent from the show, you don't notice him, right?
Like practice. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, the big thing with Omega, right, is there was this long gap where he wasn't on the show.
Yes.
And it wasn't like the show. If you're an Omega fan, of course you missed him. You wanted him to come back. I get that. I hear you, Trisha, yelling at your podcast right now. But if you actually just watch the show week to week, it's not like you're like, oh man, I really missed the Omega segment. Because it's not like he comes out there and delivers linchpin promos as either a heel or a babyface that really got it over. Even when he was a heel, so much of the reason the heel stuff worked was Don Callis. He was able to really kind of coast as Callis's second in a lot of those scenes. Don's managing me, and then Don Callis does most of the talking, and Omega comes in there as Don's buddy occasionally. And then as a babyface here, it's basically nothing until we get to his 30-second tagline of goodbye, good night, 4 score and 7 years ago, farewell and thank you, goodbye forever, so long, the end.
That's awful. Check, yeah.
Checkmate, game, set, match.
One last thing. We're actually going longer than I thought we would, but
I feel like on the weeks where we don't love the shows, it's like we'll circle back and now it turns into this decompress and digest the last 4 to 6 weeks of the general energy of all of this crap we've been consuming. And I'm like, let's take stock. Where are we emotionally at right now, having watched Raw and Dynamite for the last six weeks? I feel like this is emotionally taking stock this week.
Okay. Ospreay and Swerve are totally losing this match to the Young Bucks, who, by the way, that was a waste. That felt like a rib on all of us about the about videos and recaps and doing those types of things. This felt like a
everything BTS about match. The Bucks and Ospreay and Swerve Strickland, it felt, when I was watching that show, I don't think this, but it felt as though they had listened to you and me screed about how there were no stakes and none of this made sense, and like how it would really make sense if that Ospreay and Strickland came out here and wanted to hand things over to an impartial board of directors, a fan, so sort of a semi-fan approved board of directors and everything like that. It's like they heard that. They're like, Chris and Jeff are jerks. I hate those two. And they're like, and Tony Khan in particular was like, board of directors, everyone loves me.
Okay.
Well, everyone loves me.
No. I just heard the snorting noise. I went, okay, are we saying something about Tony Khan that we probably shouldn't be? But let's just continue and move on.
I mean, maybe it does take a little puff, a little trip on the ski, a weekend ski vacation might inspire you to think that the one thing that the fans have been clamoring for is the idea that you, Tony Khan, are the savior. Because the last time the Bucks beat the shit out of you, the crowd was emotionally really battered by that, and they haven't ever fully recovered from that. So now Ospreay and Strickland, in an effort to be cool, are going to come out here and be the Knights of Tony Khan. Tony needs his little toys to come out here and fight for his honor.
I think they're losing.
No, I hope they do, because this idea that, like, we got to send it back to the fans, and you know who the fans really love? Tony Khan is one of the lamest, most corporate fealty pieces of crap. And if you thought the CM Punk shit was tedious and annoying, and you don't find this Ospreay and Swerve Strickland stuff tedious and annoying, I might suggest to you your problem is not corporate fealty storylines, it's something else. But I hate corporate fealty storylines. So this was just nails on a chalkboard. Oh, I love my boss. Oh, I love my boss. There's a guy with hearing loss thanks to shitty bosses. This just, from what I can still hear, sounds like nails on a chalkboard.
But Chris, they won't get to fight for the world title for a whole year. And there's plenty of people who can fight for the world title while Ospreay and Swerve have their three-month feud over arguing whose fault it was that they lost. And then we get like Takeshita and Okada and Omega and maybe even Jericho and a rematch with Moxley. You can do that, and that's why I think they're probably going to lose.
But pulling Ospreay to the side is stupid. So ridiculous. Yes, it's he stupid. Was your major signing last year.
He should be champion now.
Yes. So the idea that you're even entertaining pulling him out of title contention is brain dead.
Yes.
Brain neutral is one that I like, too. Just not putting any blood flow into the cerebellum here.
Chris, we're going to get the Cody storyline right this time when he took himself out of the world title.
Yeah, that was such a draw. And you know how I know that that was a big money moment? I saw it at the beginning of this episode of Dynamite when they were recapping all of the great moments in AEW history.
And on that note, we'll go to Vader Club, my pick. From MLW, which we've never really dove into before, but I was in the mood to watch an LA Park match and a La Parka match. And so I went to Cage Match and this and it said, oh, Jacob Fatu versus LA Park. And I'm like, I'm here for this. I'm good with this. And this, all my bloody hoss fight, hardcore match expectations were met by this because... And then I read up on L.A. Park's run in MLW and how it ended. L.A. Park was a jerk at this time, taking liberties with guys, being a little bit too stiff, and also making sure that both of his sons were also booked for whatever cards they could get on for MLW. This felt like it was a struggle of wills, but man, Jacob Fatu's awesome in this. The Fosbury flop dive 3/4 of the way through the match on bare feet on the concrete. Mad respect for that, because that looks like it sucks if you do it over and over again. Both are bloody. LA Park has half his mask on by the end of this because they're just tearing and ripping at each other's foreheads. I believe this is heel on heel. I think both managers are heel have heel factions in here. I don't know the intricacies of the storytelling during this time of the Contra stable versus Serena De La Renta's stable at all. So I don't know anything for a fact. There's a little bit too much manager interference for my liking, but overall, a nice bloody brawl. Grizzled L.A. Park, not as fun as WCW Chairman L.A. Park, but still a lot of
no,
fun.
No, decidedly not. He is large here. If you have not,
yes.
He wasn't small in WCW.
Yeah.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Right. No. Like he had La Parka for lunch. You know what I really liked? Like early on in this match, is there's some good dastardly heel spots.
Yes.
That Park does. I like the off the ropes tossing the referee into Fatu and using that like malfunction at the junction to set up his own clothesline. I dug that.
I actually dug the fireball to the face of the ref because it's a no DQ match. So it's like, well, screw it. We're going to go all the way with it. And then a second, luckily, I mean, they had competency and the second ref came down and things like that. But like when they fireballed the ref, I was like, well, that's impressive. You know, that's a step above, you know, just putting like the ref through a table or doing a spot where they're made of paper mache. But I agree with you.
It also does feel like, especially after you mentioned that, and I'm like, you have it on as we're talking about it. I've seen some spots here where it does feel like L.A. Park is kind of not going
with
the program.
He's not cooperating.
There's a few of those corner spots in particular.
Yeah, yes.
He strikes
no,
and
that,
stuff.
That, that,
and,
that's
and he when, won't do, he just won't give Fatu the cells.
Well, you hear it almost towards, there's one towards the end. Like, I think it's when he does the somersault shoulder block, they call it. But I think it's more like he hits him with his leg or whatever. Where they're in that corner, they're kind of tearing at each other's foreheads a little bit. But you can tell there's a conversation going on and you can hear Fatu finally say, okay. Where they're almost negotiating having to do a spot. And this felt like... And I listened to Conan talk about why did the Parks have such a short run in there. And he goes, because every time he'd come in for a match, he'd go into business for himself here. And I believe that. This feels like L.A. Park at times was doing the bare minimum of having to get Jacob Fatu over. But at the same time, I'm going to get my stuff in. And I'm also going to take a few liberties.
I mean, it's the weird obsession with like needing to look good. And it's like, okay, yeah. But like, dude, you're not even like taking care of yourself right now. So like, what is this? Like, why are we, you know, like it'd be one thing if he looked, you know, in his 50s, he looked like Tim Storm, right?
Yes.
Okay, I get that. Like, I get how a guy like that, where I'm like, hey, no, I'm still in great shape here, guys. I can't just be blown over by a ceiling fan. You're not that. You know, like I'm not saying don't have any resistance, but I'm also sitting here going like, dude, this idea that you need to protect the image, you protect the image by hitting a treadmill at this point.
Yes.
All right, worry less about not taking that extra suplex and worry more about maybe doing some crunches.
Yeah, he's big in this match.
He's doing all right. My thought here is not, oh, body shame. It's almost like from a physicality standpoint, dude, imagine being that age, that weight, and taking those bumps.
And trying to do all that. Yeah, because you don't feel as well as you did when you were a young man.
I mean, look. I've lost weight since I was younger, a substantial amount. But when I fall now, goddamn, I feel it. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah, so I couldn't imagine putting on weight.
I bruise a lot.
Putting on weight, putting on 20 years, and yeah, then still be, and then have the 20 years of wear and tear, oh, by the way, in between.
Still a fun watch. It's on YouTube if you want to look for it.
And totally a fun time capsule of Fatu, who clearly shows all of the extreme flashes of talent
Yes.
That we're now seeing coming to fruition now. And it's just a reminder again, Look, you might not love the over-gimmicking, the big-dogging of Fatu, but he's really talented. He's very talented.
That's it there. This has been Shake Them Ropes. You can follow me on X at CrapGame13. You can just follow the show at Shake Them Ropes. I also do a show for Fight Game Media on Wednesdays, about 20 minutes after Dynamite goes off the air with Paul Fontaine, thoroughly deconstructing that show, which is why I don't go into as much detail on it here. But that's on YouTube for free, and it drops in your podcatchers on the Fight Game Media or just the Dynamite Show feed for free the next morning. Chris would like to get his plugs in now, and he'd like you to purchase some music lessons from him.
Yes, get music lessons from me, Instagram.com. The first single from the album, I have been told, is going to be arriving on my desk in the not-so-distant future, which means it will be arriving on your Spotify in the not-so-distant future, like probably within the month. So now is an excellent time to go and subscribe to my Spotify, which is under Chris Novembrino. I have not renamed the project or anything at this point. And even if I do, it'll still just all update. So just go ahead, sub up to my Spotify, go and check out some of the demos. Some of those have been improved, enhanced, remixed for this album, but the album is ultimately going to total 17 songs. I was not trying to make Pet Sounds, but it's going to be close to an hour in length. I'm proud of it. I hope you guys like it when it comes out, and I am excited for the finished product. So go do that. If you want lessons, hit me up. And always remember,
hold on,
Big Papa Pump. Oh,
give your handle on Instagram. You haven't yet.
DOCTOR_NOV. And remember, Big Papa Pump is your hookup. Holler if you hear him.
Hi, I'm Case Lowe, co-host of the Open the Voice Gate podcast. The one question I'm constantly asked when it comes to Dragon Gate is, how do I get into the promotion? Well, stop asking and start listening to the Open the Voice Gate podcast, released every Wednesday on the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. For exclusive news and show reviews, look no further than the leader in Dragon Gate coverage, Open the Voice Gate.
Love Japanese pro wrestling? Want coverage of the entire scene? Men's and women's promotions from New Japan to Stardom, NOAH, All Japan, DDT, Marigold, and more, then Wrestling Omakase is the podcast for you. Hosted by a 23-year Puro Watching veteran, that's me, John Carroll, and a rotating cast of co-hosts, we bring you a passionate, knowledgeable look at the wide world of Japanese wrestling. Wrestling Omakase is right here on the Voices of Wrestling Network. Check us out on any podcast app or feed today.